away with a better deal than virtually anyone else. Due to the arm-twisting from the government, they're called Uncle Sam because they're really good at getting people to say, Uncle. Companies and investors that had lent Chrysler the capital they needed to stay afloat were forced to take it on the chin, but not the unions. For example, consider the International Union, United Automobile, Aerospace, and Agricultural Implement Workers of America, better known as the UAW. Their sacrifice was to make unspecified cuts to wages and benefits, alter some work rules, and waive Chrysler's $8 billion payment to their retiree health care fund. Okay, that sounds fair, you're probably thinking, but that's only because you haven't heard what they got in return. A $4.6 billion government loan to a new retiree health care fund, $600 million for their pension fund, and, icing on the cake, a whopping 55% equity stake in the newly reorganized Chrysler. In other words, the unions now own more than half of Chrysler, all for a measly $3 billion. Other parties didn't fare quite so well. Before the bankruptcy, Daimler held $2 billion in secured loans to Chrysler and owned a 19% stake in the company. After the deal, in a disappearing act that would make Houdini jealous, Daimler waived the $2 billion they were owed and also gave up their entire stake in Chrysler. What did they get in return? The privilege of putting an additional $600 million into the UAW pension fund. Cerberus, a private equity firm that was basically the life preserver to Chrysler's flailing, splashing, drowning business, was also strong-armed into giving up everything for nothing in return. Prior to the government-led agreement, Cerberus held $500 million in secured loans, an 80% stake in Chrysler, and full ownership of Chrysler's headquarters. After the arrangement, the firm gave up all of its assets and received absolutely nothing in return. Who was negotiating this deal for them? Gerald Levin? And, of course, let's not forget the taxpayer. Remember when the government loaned Chrysler $4 billion in TARP funds and another $3.2 billion in bankruptcy financing? Hope you weren't too attached to it. And it's not like we really need the money anyway, because it's all gone. But here's the best news of all. We're lending the company another $4.7 billion. Isn't the definition of insanity doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result?
Excuse me, ADD moment.
In return for the new $4.7 billion loan, taxpayers got an 80% equity stake in Chrysler.
Oh, but don't worry. Now that we officially own a big piece of Chrysler doesn't mean that the government is going to be involved in their turnaround. No, remember, the president doesn't want to run auto companies. He's got more than enough to do, end quote. You know, like running our banks.
Even Canadian taxpayers got screwed over by this disaster. The Canadian government handed over $3 billion in loans, which, and you have to admire their honesty, they assume Chrysler won't ever be repaying. Talk about a raw deal, eh?
Well, good for them. I mean, look at the results unions have achieved for their workers. Isn't it important for working people to make as much money as possible? Aren't you, Mr. Capitalist?
I sure am. When Americans make money from the fruits of their free market labor, it's the greatest thing in the world. But when they make it based on blackmail, monopolies, and taxpayer funds, not so much. Big labor will constantly, and I mean constantly, tell you about how their workers make more money than a corresponding non-union employee. And they're absolutely right. But there is an old saying that while statistics don't lie, liars use statistics. And this so-called union triumph is a great example of that. Yes, union workers make an average of $195 more per week than non-union workers. But is that really the whole story? After all, inmates in state prisons pay far less in health care benefits than their non-jailed counterparts. Does that mean we should all strive to do 20 to life? Of course not, because being in a union, like being in prison, has consequences. Unions are able to attain higher pay and unheard-of retirement goodies for their workers because they can hold companies and taxpayers hostage. It doesn't hurt their case that most of them operate in government-backed cartels, either. But even if you're okay with that, the data itself is still skewed. Union workers typically have automatic raises built into their contracts. In times when the economy is in a downturn and most workers are taking cuts, union workers stick to their guns and demand their contractual raises. Higher pay is a great benefit of unions, but there is a major downside. Your salary doesn't really matter if you no longer have a job. So while unions trumpet the wages they secure for their members, they bury statistics that reveal how their heavy-handed policies cost jobs. There are other consequences to unionization as well, because when unions win, consumers lose. The costs of unrealistic contracts aren't borne by greedy executives, they're borne by customers, many of whom are also hard-working men and women. By not basing labor costs on a free market system of supply and demand, expenses quickly become out of whack with reality. Over time, those expenses, high salaries, unheard-of pensions, low-cost healthcare, etc., inevitably increase the cost of products, thereby destroying industries, cars, airlines, etc., and costing thousands of people their jobs. Mark J. Perry, a professor of economics and finance at the University of Michigan and an expert on the car industry, calculated the average compensation for employees of the big three auto companies, including benefits, at $73 an hour. At the same time, U.S.-based employees, who are apparently not working men and women, of Japanese automakers earn $48 an hour, 52% less. In 2007, the legacy costs, things like pensions and healthcare costs, of every car produced by the Detroit Big Three amounted to $1,800. These days, because production is down and early retirement is up, legacy costs now account for around $3,000 per car. Think about what those costs do to a business trying to compete in a global free market against other companies that don't have that same albatross around their necks. A car that costs an automaker $20,000 to make jumps to $23,000 before a profit is even considered. That puts U.S. automakers at a severe disadvantage to their counterparts, a disadvantage that has finally proven too much to overcome. But it's not only the legacy costs. If you really want to see how deeply inefficiency, waste, and plain stupidity are embedded into the union mindset, look no further than job banks, an idea that only a combination of government and organized labor could possibly dream up. In the 1980s, some Detroit automakers like GM and Chrysler placated the auto unions by creating the Job Opportunity Bank Security System, or job banks for short. Despite their name, those banks weren't about creating jobs, they were about keeping people without them busy. Union employees who were laid off were put into these banks and paid nearly their full salary to just hang out and improve themselves watching movies and taking enrichment classes. After the auto bailouts, many Americans were so disgusted by job banks that the pressure finally became too much and unions officially began to close them. Participants, who had already been laid off once, were all laid off again. Sort of. This time, they went home and began collecting over 72% of their full-time pay. That, my friends, is what they call union sacrifice.
ADD moment. President Obama fired General Motors Chairman and CEO Rick Wagoner, a man selected by a private board of directors and approved by private shareholders. But what about Ron Gettelfinger, head of the United Auto Workers Union? He was the man on the other side of every labor contract Wagoner had to sign. Doesn't he bear any responsibility in saddling GM with labor and benefit costs that proved completely unsustainable? No, of course not. Apparently not. No. Why? Well, as evidence of how much the unions had given back in trying to keep GM solvent, UAW President Ron Gettelfinger told the Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee that they'd agreed to slash wages in half for new workers and exclude them from the legacy health and pension plans that were saddling the company. Sounds great, except for one little problem. Since 2000, the number of hourly workers at GM is down 50%. So in other words, there aren't any new workers.
Okay, unions might not work in the auto industry, but they certainly work for the public sector.
One of the major reasons that unions first came into existence was to provide a balance against the power of monopolies. Monopolies made it nearly impossible for workers to get a fair shake because they had nearly complete power over their respective industries. That's why it's ironic that unions now rely on the biggest and most powerful monopoly in the world to acquire and maintain their power, the government. While most of us rely on competition and a sense of personal achievement to bring out our best, public union employees are protected regardless of their talents or accomplishments. And that goes to the very core of what's wrong with unions. They celebrate mediocrity. What is the point in exerting yourself when the reward doesn't change? What is the point of coming in early, staying late, or putting any extra effort into your job when your status and pay are defined by a 500-page collective bargaining agreement? If you think this is an overly harsh critique, just look at one of the most prevalent and powerful examples of this in the country, teachers' unions. First, the requisite disclaimers. There are a ton of great teachers in America, many of whom have decided to forego far more lucrative careers because of their love of education. And it's often a thankless job. Anyone who has kids knows how tough it can be. But the unions only make the task even harder. They virtually guarantee that mediocre teachers stick around while high-performing ones get so frustrated that they leave. Let's imagine for a moment a world without teachers' unions. All employment would be at will. Teachers would work at a school because they want to, and conversely, schools would employ only teachers that are doing a good job. Like employees at most businesses, teachers would strive to do their best in order to get promoted or receive a year-end bonus, and bad or dangerous teachers would be immediately dismissed, no questions asked. In other words, let's imagine a world where teachers earn their salaries through hard work and talent, and where, as a result, American children lead the world in academic achievement. Okay, the crazy dream sequence is now over. Back to reality. Unions invest far more heavily in controlling school boards and stocking state houses and city councils with friendly supporters than they do in actual education. And that is where a government-union partnership is at its most destructive. Out of 43,000 tenured teachers in the entire Los Angeles school district, which has a less than 50% graduation rate, only 112 were terminated for the entire decade of 1995 to 2005. That's 0.26% of teachers. Talk about job security. A Los Angeles Public School Union representative explained why there are so few firings. If I'm representing them, it's impossible to get them out. It's impossible, unless they commit a lewd act. But that rep may have spoken too soon, because in some districts, even a lewd act may not be enough. When 2020 anchor and best-selling author John Stossel confronted New York City public school chancellor Joel Klein about a teacher who sent a sexually explicit email to one of his 16-year-old students, he got a taste of how hard it is to get rid of a teacher. "He admits to it," Klein told Stossel. "We had the email." "You can't fire him?" Stossel asked. "It's almost impossible." "Why?" According to Stossel, it's because of the rules detailed in the New York school system's 200-page contract with their teachers. There are so many rules that principals rarely even try to jump through all the hoops required to fire a bad teacher. It took 6 years of expensive litigation before the teacher was fired. During those 6 years, he received more than $300,000 in salary. Do we want our private industry to be run like the school systems of major urban areas? If unions have their way, that's exactly what is going to happen.
Chapter 6. Illegal Immigration. The chapter America Just Won't Write. U.S. Code, Title 8, Section 1325. Any alien who, 1. enters or attempts to enter the United States at any time or place other than as designated by immigration officers, or 2. eludes examination or inspection by immigration officers, shall, for the first commission for any such offense, be fined under Title 18 or imprisoned, not more than 6 months or both, and for a subsequent commission of any such offense, be fined under Title 18 or imprisoned, not more than 2 years or both. Approximately 2,000 people willfully ignore that statute every day, making illegal immigration a national crisis that you're apparently not supposed to notice. Official estimates of our illegal population range from 10 to 20 million. And, at least if we're to believe the politicians and activists, not a single one of those people is anything other than a hard-working, down-on-their-luck foreigner just trying to provide for their family. Americans are begging Congress, mayors, governors, anybody who will listen, to simply enforce our laws. But they're not listening. In fact, it seems like the only people who are being heard are the activists, who viciously attack anyone who dares suggest that illegal immigration might be, well, illegal. For example, they're hiding under the American flag, claiming to be good patriots, but they're actually promoting racial hatred. LULAC chapter president Paul Martinez on Minuteman patrols. He is, without question, a racist. Protester at San Diego campus of University of California speaking about Lou Dobbs. Nothing short of base racism. Nativo V. Lopez, president of the Mexican American Political Association, after Governor Schwarzenegger called for closed borders. The message they're trying to send is that white people can take the law into their own hands and do whatever they want to people of color. And in the 21st century America, that is just not going to fly. Ray Ybarra, ACLU worker who organized against the Minuteman Project. This announcement blatantly promotes baseless persecution of Latinos. Is it KMBC's new policy to turn Kansas City into a police state? Will Kansas citizens start turning anyone who has brown skin over to immigration officials? Most people find turning their fellow human beings over to persecution and destruction rather distasteful. It was distasteful when the Europeans turned in Jews to the Nazis. It was distasteful when the Japanese were interred. People should not be punished or destroyed for existing. Clara Reyes, editor of Dos Mundos, after Kansas City TV station KBMC aired a public service announcement asking citizens to report illegal aliens to authorities. Wrong-headed and bigoted. Its intention is to scare Latinos out of the state. Bill Chandler of the Mississippi Immigrant Rights Alliance, speaking of the Mississippi Employment Protection Act, designed to crack down on illegal hiring practices. We're a nation of immigrants. Not only do I understand that, I also cherish it. But that has nothing to do with the issue we're talking about. And spinning an argument about the rule of law into one about hatred for immigrants is unfair to what should otherwise be a legitimate debate.
Oh, but Glenn, we have to help the less fortunate.
I agree. But it's not quite that cut and dried. Illegal immigration activists know that if they can get people to rely on their compassion instead of on the law, they win. But that doesn't make it a logical argument. The truth is that over 3 billion people in the world live on less than $2.50 a day. The real question isn't whether we should be compassionate. Absolutely, we should. But to whom? Who's the most deserving of our charity? Those who break our laws, or those who have done everything by the book and still can't make ends meet? Oh, it's easy to look at the family of struggling illegal aliens and feel your heart break. But should they have priority over the family of Americans who have paid taxes for decades and are now facing joblessness, homelessness, and a massive health care bill? If the latest economic crisis taught us anything, it's that we cannot help everyone. We're a charitable country. which is why we've allowed so many people to sneak in here for so long with virtually no repercussions. But there's nothing charitable or compassionate about looking the other way while employers pay illegal wages and force workers to endure grueling hours in unsafe conditions. In fact, I believe that's the opposite of compassion. It's economic slavery.
The less you know. A few years ago, some research was done to figure out how the Bush administration successfully connected the war in Iraq to 9/11. They figured out that it all had to do with the words that were chosen, and their findings supported that theory. Those who control the language control the argument. And those who control the argument are more likely to successfully translate belief into policy. The exact same thing is happening with the immigration debate. They're not illegal immigrants or illegal aliens. They're migrant workers or economic refugees. What's next? Unlicensed entrepreneurs?
Senator Bill Frist once said, "A nation that can't secure its borders, can't secure its destiny, or administer its laws." As long as our borders are as secure as a job at General Motors, I'd have to agree. So how do we change our fate? Well, by using some common sense. Against idiotic arguments like,
"Illegal aliens are doing the jobs that Americans just won't do."
Americans build bridges, work in coal mines, collect garbage, slaughter chickens, clean sewers, and much worse. Have you ever seen dirty jobs? I'm not exactly sure what job it is that Americans won't do. I guess it would help if those who make this stupid argument were a little more specific. A more accurate argument would be that illegal aliens take the jobs that Americans can't do because employers won't pay minimum wage or provide reasonable benefits or safe working conditions. I realize I'm not as well versed in economics as Ben Bernanke, but I am a thinker. It seems to me that if you flood the market with lots of cheap labor, wages go down. Supply and demand, right? If you supply businesses with millions of workers willing to make $3 an hour, then demand for higher-priced minimum wage workers goes down. Data on illegal jobs is inconclusive. It turns out that employers aren't real big on telling the government about all the laws they're breaking. However, studies have shown that minorities and the poor are hit the hardest by illegal labor entering the market. Again, I bring you back to the word compassion. People may think they're helping one family by looking the other way as they cross the Rio Grande, but they're hurting three other families in the process.
ADD moment. Bear Stearns reported that between 4 and 6 million jobs have been moved to the underground economy since 1990. Those aren't the jobs Americans just won't do, but rather the jobs they used to do before illegal labor became much more attractive to employers. If the president is really serious about creating or saving 600,000 jobs, he could do it a whole lot faster by cracking down on companies that hire illegal workers rather than by funneling billions into subsidizing solar panels and windmills.
Relying on cheap labor also has another impact, one that often goes unseen. It makes businesses lazy. Those who have fallen into the dreamy bliss of illegal labor don't have to upgrade equipment, streamline processes, or deal with human resource issues because they're virtually guaranteed high profits due to their unfairly low labor costs.
ADD moment. The Roman Empire based its economy on slave labor, which reduced exports and hindered technological innovation. I think we all remember how that whole Roman Empire thing worked out.
If every illegal alien left the country tomorrow, we'd still build new homes and grow fruit and, reluctantly, vegetables. How? By leveling the playing field. When Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, conducted raids on cheating employers who got ahead by hiring illegal workers and paying them illegal wages, some amazing things started to happen. Swift & Company meat processing plants lost about 9% of their workforce when they were raided in 6 states. After the raids, Swift raised their pay by almost $2 an hour, and hundreds of residents lined up the next day to take the jobs illegal aliens used to have. Howard Industries, an electronics maker in Laurel, Mississippi, was raided in the fall of 2008. Hundreds of citizens soon lined up to apply for the new job opportunities, including one woman who drove 40 miles. Crider Inc., a chicken processing plant in Stillmore, Georgia, suddenly raised their pay to more than a dollar an hour over what they were paying illegal aliens. About 400 unemployed people showed up for interviews, half of whom were subsequently hired. Those are only three examples out of hundreds of raids, but you can't tell me that Americans are unwilling to work. When fair jobs become available, Americans line up to do them. And if a company goes under because of illegal labor violations, then they obviously weren't meant to survive anyway.
Shh, don't tell Tim Geithner.
Oh, great. So we crack down on employers and then our economy collapses. Like it or not, illegal workers are vital to keeping things cheap.
Don't be fooled by those who say that illegal aliens contribute billions to our economy and take little from it. They're wrong. Many work off the books, earn low wages, pay little to no taxes, send millions of dollars in remittances to their home country, and use social services at a higher rate than American citizens. The truth is that, yes, illegal aliens are important to our economy, but only if you're talking about the destruction of it. Illegal immigrants tend to be less skilled and less educated than those who got off the ships at Ellis Island. While new immigrants used to earn just 14% less than native-born Americans, that gap had widened to an average of 34% less by 1998. Before the New Deal, if you came to America and couldn't make it, you went home. Now, our growing welfare state is feeding off those who fall short of the education and skills necessary to achieve the American dream. Illegal immigrants are 50% more likely to use welfare than citizens. They get free education, Medicaid, cash assistance for kids, the WIC program, and sometimes food stamps. While children of illegal immigrants make up only 6% of the population, they account for almost 12% of our nation's poor. The progressive magazine Mother Jones reported, "We can be virtually certain that illegal immigrants earn less than $24,000 per year on average, probably much less. Workers who earn so little pay very little income tax. A majority of illegal immigrants fall below the income threshold at which income taxes become significantly positive. Yes, illegal aliens pay some taxes because they buy things. You can't live in this country and avoid paying sales tax or, in some cases, even Social Security tax if you are lucky enough to steal someone's Social Security number or buy one on a street corner in California for about $150. We're being taken advantage of worse than Lindsay Lohan at a frat party. Our nation spends more than $4.7 billion a year on health care for illegal aliens, and California has been forced to close over 70 hospitals over the last 10 years alone. About 17% of all those in federal prison are illegal aliens, an astonishing number when you consider that they represent only 3% of the population. Of course, free room and board in prison isn't free. We're paying for them to be there as well. We're also spending about $30 billion each year to educate illegal aliens in our schools, money that we could probably use to figure out how to educate our own children, since we're doing such a miserable job at it right now.
You are looking at this all wrong. Legal versus illegal. It's irrelevant, because borders, they're just not necessary anymore.
Despite what you may read in liberal blogs, nobody believes that all illegal aliens are terrorists, but the problem is that those who come here to work and those who come here to kill are all using the same door. Law enforcement will readily admit that they have no idea exactly how many people are slipping into the country undetected. They know only how many get caught. As one U.S. terrorism official reported to the House Committee on Homeland Security in 2006, "We don't even know what we don't know." The most obvious problem, and the one that will get you labeled an intolerant xenophobe the fastest, is the 2,000-mile border we share with Mexico. Almost 70% of illegal aliens are Mexican, and our border agents simply can't keep up. A typical day on the border means sorting through the latest crop of crossers to determine their nationality. If they're Mexican, and it appears they aren't wanted in the U.S. for a crime, we send them back to Mexico. If they're other than Mexican, OTM, even if they're from one of the special interest countries that make us nervous, they're usually released right onto our streets. Why? Because we can't send them to Mexico, and since our detention centers are usually full, we can't lock them up. Therefore, we politely ask them if they wouldn't mind hanging out in the United States while they wait for their immigration hearing. You can probably guess how that works out. 85% of catch-and-release aliens are never seen again. Releasing lawbreakers into society is incredibly frustrating for Border Patrol agents who thought they signed on to uphold the law and instead find out that they're professional babysitters. TJ Bonner, president of the National Border Patrol Council, says that it's more than a little demoralizing. Agents feel like social workers. They're not enforcing the law. They're simply enabling people to break it. And that goes against the grain of any law enforcement officer. On February 18, 2009, Catherine Herridge of Fox News reported that there are currently 554,000 illegal alien fugitives on the loose in the U.S. If only 0.001% of them want to do any harm to the country, that means we're looking for five or six needles in a haystack made of needles. I don't know about you, but I don't really feel like playing the odds when it comes to terrorism. It's ironic that if you bring up the idea that a few of the millions of people who've come here illegally might be terrorists, you're called a fearmonger or a racist, as if you're trying to scare people into sealing our borders. I say it's ironic because apparently the only time you're allowed to make the case that something terrible might happen is after something terrible does happen. It's as though people will only be convinced that our open borders are a security threat if we happen to catch Osama bin Laden himself trying to paddle across the Rio Grande. Why, for once in our history, can't we be proactive about something? Rapes, kidnappings, murders, and unspeakable violence are happening almost daily in our border cities. Phoenix, Arizona now has the second highest number of kidnappings in the world. And according to a report from the U.S. Joint Forces Command, Mexico is at risk of a rapid and sudden collapse. Yet, we still don't think it's time to take practical precautions? Actual terrorists must look at our open borders with a mix of anticipation and bewilderment. Al-Qaeda gets most of the public's attention, but Hezbollah, which an FBI official says makes Al-Qaeda look like Sunday schoolers, has already taken note of our messy southern border. The 9/11 Commission report said that Lebanese nationals sympathetic to Hezbollah and Hamas entered the U.S. with the help of corrupt Mexican officials, and in March 2006, FBI Director Mueller reported that his agency busted a Hezbollah smuggling ring that was using the Mexican border to get operatives into the United States. A former DEA agent reported in March 2009 that Hezbollah relies on the same criminal weapon smugglers, document traffickers, and transportation experts as the drug cartels. In March 2005, FBI Director Robert Mueller told the House Appropriations Subcommittee, "There are individuals from countries with known Al-Qaeda connections who are changing their Islamic surnames to Hispanic-sounding names and obtaining false Hispanic identities, learning to speak Spanish, and pretending to be Hispanic immigrants. Maybe they're all going to move to Mexico and live happily ever after, or maybe they're going to come here and blow up buildings. The point is that there are too many maybes involved for my liking."
The less you know. The Postal Service can't get your birthday card to Grandma on time, but the government is apparently capable of sending illegal gang members back home for Christmas. According to a federal investigator, an MS-13 gang member who was in the U.S. illegally wanted to get a free trip home for Christmas, so he turned himself in to the authorities. Did it work? Yep. They sent him home on the taxpayer's dime, where he spent the holidays with his family, and then returned to the U.S. by illegally crossing the southwest border. In fact, the ploy worked so well that he did it over and over again.
Another incident involving terrorists in our borders happened in early 2009 when Al-Qaeda recruiter Abdullah al-Nafisi was seen on video talking about how they could exploit our southern border. 4 pounds of anthrax in a suitcase this big, carried by a fighter through tunnels from Mexico into the U.S., are guaranteed to kill 330,000 Americans within a single hour if it's properly spread in population centers there, al-Nafisi said. What a horrifying idea. 9/11 will be small change in comparison. Am I right? There is no need for airplanes, conspiracies, timings, and so on. One person with the courage to carry 4 pounds of anthrax will go to the White House lawn and spread this confetti all over them, and then we'll do these cries of joy. It will turn into a real celebration. Is that just propaganda to convince new recruits that Al-Qaeda is still relevant? Perhaps, but considering that the tunnels he mentions actually exist, we would be smart to take him at his word. While the crisis down south gets all of the headlines, the open Canadian border is just as dangerous. It's twice the size of the Mexican border, and we have only 1/5 of the Border Patrol agents stationed there. Up until late 2007, Canadian border agents had no access to firearms and had to call the Canadian police to handle dangerous individuals. Canada expects to train and arm all of their guards by 2017, but as of now, some have only pepper spray, a baton, and the ability to yell "A" very loudly. You do the math. While all of the stats and studies are nice, the winning response to the border argument really revolves around common sense. I defy you to name just one nation that has prospered without defending its borders. You won't be able to. And the reason is simple. Open borders not only invite violence and national security concerns, they also inevitably result in a country importing poverty while exporting high-paying jobs and wealthy, educated citizens. Keep that up for as long as we have, and soon you'll have a country with massive deficits, growing rates of unemployment, and fewer wealthy people able to support them all. Oh, wait a second.
Oh, so that means you want a fence, eh?
Okay, stop with the Canadian accent. I don't want a fence. I want two of them. And I want them double-layered and really, really high. Some people will point out that we've already tried to build a fence, but it's proposed to be only 670 miles long, and government incompetence has plagued it the whole way. Critics say that the cost is too expensive, but that argument doesn't hold up when you start comparing the cost to what we've spent recently. Costs vary by mile, depending on the specifications and what kind of terrain the fence covers, but estimates range from $2 to $10 million per mile. A fence running the entire length of the U.S.-Mexican border twice, at the highest estimate of $10 million per mile, would cost us roughly $40 billion. That's expensive, right? Sure is. But it's also equal to the amount of money the stimulus bill set aside to increase and extend unemployment benefits. That's an ironic comparison, given that we likely wouldn't need those benefits extended if illegal laborers were prevented from taking American jobs. The government, along with environmentalists, has other ideas. A real fence is so old school, they say. We need to progress in our thinking and consider a virtual fence instead. I'll spare you the question of why the White House, Fort Knox, and Rikers Island all use real fences, and instead ask this. If a virtual fence is such a no-brainer, then why has it taken 3 years to even start construction on just 23 miles of cameras and sensors? In typical government fashion, even when the $6.4 billion project is complete, it won't be complete. According to the New York Times, within 5 years, the virtual fence is expected to extend along the entire 2,000-mile border, except for some 200 miles in the area of Big Bend National Park in Texas, a stretch that is to be addressed later. Isn't that kind of like installing a home security system, but putting a note on the front door saying that the back door doesn't have a sensor yet?
That's just a smokescreen. The real reason you want a fence is that you're a conspiracy nut who thinks we're merging with Canada and Mexico.
I might be crazy, but lots of stuff going on in our government doesn't add up. Or it adds up, but not in a good way. Yes, I believe there is an effort underway by a few well-connected groups to establish something akin to a North American Union. But the difference between me and the black helicopter crowd is that I don't believe it's a conspiracy. I think it's happening right out in the open, and it's all being championed by profit-minded global corporations. If you're interested in the names of the people and the companies behind this effort, you can read the illegal immigration chapter in An Inconvenient Book. I'll spare you the details here, but one key point I made is that the idea of a more cohesive hemisphere is nonpartisan. Presidents and business leaders from both sides of the aisle are becoming convinced that the economic and security benefits of uniting, like the European Union, outweigh the risks. That doesn't necessarily mean that America goes away. It just means that instead of answering only to our Constitution, we'd be answering to a whole set of additional international laws, as we do now after ratifying an international treaty.
Is President Obama a fan of this idea? Who knows? Though his nomination of Harold Coe, an avowed transnationalist who believes that we must respect the opinions of mankind, to an important State Department position would lead me to believe that he's more open to blurring borders than strengthening them. There's also the matter of Obama's odd, misleading reply to a question about the NAU, which I know is circumstantial evidence. Maybe it could be admissible in a foreign court, but is suspicious nonetheless. At a 2008 town hall meeting in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, Obama was asked about his relationship to the Council on Foreign Relations, CFR, one of the groups that allegedly supports increased globalization and a decreased focus on the sovereignty of individual countries. "I don't know if I'm an official member," Obama responded. "I've spoken there before. It's basically just a forum where a bunch of people talk about foreign policy. There's no official membership. I don't have a card or special handshake or anything like that." And then the audience laughed. He went on to discount the idea that a European Union-style entity may be on its way here by saying, "I see no evidence of this actually taking place." I have two issues with what he said. First, his hilarious joke about secret handshakes notwithstanding, the CFR most definitely does have an official membership list. In fact, the CFR's own website spends over 1,500 words describing the specific steps that one must take to become a member: complete application and submit curriculum vitae, obtain a letter of nomination from an existing member, submit 3 letters of recommendation, etc. In other words, President Obama knows very well whether he's a member, and people deserve an honest answer from him rather than a comedic dismissal. Second, regardless of whether President Obama is a CFR member, many of his advisors and cabinet members, like George Mitchell, Special Envoy to the Middle East, Richard Holbrooke, Special Envoy to Pakistan and Afghanistan, and Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner, reportedly are. Even Obama's wife Michelle was reportedly on the board of directors of the Chicago branch of the CFR. Given those connections, you'd think that the president would be a little more familiar with what the CFR has been working on, most notably their 2005 task force report entitled Building a North American Community. Sample of their findings? To that end, the task force proposes the creation by 2010 of a North American community to enhance security, prosperity, and opportunity. Its boundaries will be defined by a common external tariff and an outer security perimeter. Of course, none of this means that President Obama supports further integration between the U.S., Mexico, and Canada. But as I said in an inconvenient book, one sure way for him or any leader to prove he doesn't support it is by strongly supporting a double-layered fence along both our borders, along with crippling fines on businesses that hire illegal workers.
"Oh, great. So after we build your precious fence, then what? Do we deport everybody who's already here? That would be impossible."
The media loves to trot out stories about immigrants living in fear of deportation. For example, an ABC News story from 2008, innocently titled "Immigration Raids Cripple Small Towns," contained a section labeled "Immigrant Mother Describes Terror" about a raid at a Mississippi plant. Only once you started to read the article did you find out that the immigrant mother was actually an undocumented Mexican, and that her terror came from the fact that federal agents had the audacity to show up at the place where she was working illegally and ask her for proof of her status. Oh, the inhumanity.
The less you know. We have a deportation program going known as ICE Air. That sounds better than any commercial flight I've ever taken. At a cost to taxpayers of about $680 per one-way ticket, illegal aliens are flown home and provided with sandwiches, chips, fruit, bottled water, juice, civilian clothing, checked baggage, and a private nurse. That apparently wasn't enough for Ismael Martinez, a recent passenger being deported for domestic battery. People tell you about all the opportunities in the United States, but they don't reveal the bad things like this, where they treat us like animals, he said. If Martinez thought that was bad, I wonder what he'd think about flying on Continental.
Latino groups also love to denounce the government's usually feeble attempts at enforcement. After Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napolitano conducted deportation raids in early 2009, Some groups complained that they destroyed families and spread terror. What is rarely mentioned or quickly glossed over is that these raids are usually triggered by suspicion of identity theft, and it's that crime that is usually prosecuted. But that angle doesn't seem as sexy as big, bad U.S. government terrorizes helpless immigrants, so it's generally ignored. I know this will come as a shock to some people, but I'm actually not in favor of destroying families or spreading terror. I think it's terrible that we could potentially be taking a mother or a father away from their children. Although, to be fair, it's not like anyone is requiring that they leave their children behind. That's why I'm open to doing something that so many others aren't. Compromising. I'm more than willing to talk about a program for people who want to come out of the shadows, admit they're guilty of a crime, and pay an appropriate penalty. But, and this is where I lose most people, I'm willing to talk about that only after we have secured both borders to my satisfaction. After all, if we learned anything from Ronald Reagan's amnesty program, it should be that amnesty without security only incentivizes more people to break the law.
ADD moment. In 2004, word began to get out about President Bush's plan to offer something akin to amnesty, but definitely not amnesty, to illegal aliens. Shortly afterward, the Border Patrol began to ask those they captured why they were trying to get into the country. In some districts, as many as 90% reported that they were coming now in order to be grandfathered in for the amnesty program.
The truth is that comprehensive immigration reform should be comprehensive only in that it deals with how we will comprehensively shut down the border and turn off the job magnet first. Once that happens, it will be much easier to have a logical discussion about what to do with those people who are left, many of whom at that point will likely be trying to figure out how to get over the fence and back into Mexico on their own because of the lack of illegal jobs available here. If that doesn't work, we can always pack up our stuff and leave this country to the politicians and activists who seem to be so intent on dismantling it. Besides, I hear Mexico is nice, especially this time of year.
Chapter 7, The Nanny State. Saving you from yourself, one right at a time. If there is one thing that liberals, conservatives, communists, capitalists, vegetarians, teetotalers, pet lovers, bureaucrats, Republicans, and Democrats can all agree on, it's telling you how you should live your life. From punitive sin taxes and laws dictating your house paint color, to rules and regulations aimed at smoking, drinking, dancing, eating, washing your car in the driveway, keeping a cat in your store, smiling for your driver's license, or playing tag, you can rest assured that local, state, and federal governments are more ready and willing and able than ever before to make decisions for you. Laws and taxes are passed in the name of improving community standards, keeping you safe and healthy, maintaining order, spreading morality, or because somebody somewhere complained, died, or had their feelings hurt. Even if a seemingly trivial ban on the sale of cheap cigars doesn't affect you directly, eventually one of these mini-tyrannies will. Before you know it, you'll find yourself breaking the law because your pants are too baggy, or you didn't wear a helmet for soccer, you went trick-or-treating when you were 12, or perish the thought, you sat on a milk crate. Where is all of this madness coming from? Good intentions. A great deal of the plague of the nanny state stems from the desire of various individuals to make the world a better place for everyone. The proverbial greater good argument that progressives so often recite. Of course, a better place means different things to different people. And that's kind of a big part of the problem. Fidel Castro thinks he made Cuba better. But there are still just a couple of folks that might disagree. Nanny statism often starts with a universally accepted noble idea that on its own seems quite hard to argue with. For example, we must stop drunk drivers. They're a menace. They kill thousands of people a year and put innocent families at risk. So you say, heck yeah, we need to get rid of drunk drivers. But how? In the nanny state, the answer is, by law, of course, using legislation to solve an issue at the expense of some of your personal liberty.
And laws, as we all know, are subject to mission creep. ADD moment. First they came for the cigarettes, and I didn't speak up because I'm not a smoker. Then they came for the trans fats, and I didn't speak up because I'm a healthy eater. Then they came for the foie gras, and I didn't speak up because, I mean, it's French. Then they came for the ice cream, and I didn't speak up because I'm lactose intolerant. And then they came for the ribeye, and by that time, there was no one left to speak up because all of the restaurants were already out of business. The United States was founded on a few simple principles: life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Those are some of my favorite hits. I'll leave life and happiness for another time, but right now I want to deal with liberty, since that's something the nanny state movement isn't quite able to fully comprehend. The principle of liberty puts each of us in control of making the decisions that will affect our lives. Us, for better or for worse. Thomas Jefferson put it like this:
"It does me no injury for my neighbor to say there are 20 gods or no god. It neither picks my pocket nor breaks my leg."
In other words, you and I are free to think as we like and do as we like, as long as it doesn't harm someone else. Live and let live. Simple, right? No, not so much anymore. Not with the state involved. Back to drunk driving. The nanny state approach is to use the police department to set up roadblocks and spot checks, which, as a fun side benefit, helps concentrate law enforcement personnel in one area, thereby creating traffic jams and penalizing innocent people who are merely trying to get home from work. Then the idea becomes more intrusive and inane: banning the sale of cold beer, banning the sale of fruity adult drinks, dictating the exact composition of a martini, watering down beer, making establishments and their workers liable for your getting drunk, demanding happy hour be renamed, and the grand prize, requiring ignition-locking breathalyzers in all cars, an idea promoted by nanny statist New York Assemblyman Felix Ortiz. Does it matter if you don't drink at all or that you never ever would consider driving under the influence? No. It'll be a round of breathalyzers for everybody, please. ADD moment. Some hospitals collected DNA samples from newborns so they could be screened for genetic predispositions to disease. Kind of sounds like a good idea, doesn't it? Until mission creep kicked in, and suddenly the government was saying, hey, why don't we hold on to these samples for, like, let's say, forever? Completely unrelated ADD moment. I wonder if scientists will ever discover a gene that makes people prone to revolutionary thought. If so, I wonder if those babies will ever live life outside a prison cell. Oh, a completely unrelated ADD moment. Should I call Steven Spielberg and tell him that I have the premise for Minority Report 2? Now, if you happen to make the really, really terrible decision to get liquored up and hit the road, you deserve to be severely punished. Choosing to call a friend or a cab is your personal responsibility, and until recently, each of us used to be personally responsible for it. But no, not anymore. Now the government, assisted by a wide assortment of legislation-happy enablers, has decided that it knows what's best for you. And that is the problem. In their effort to make the world better, nannies enact nuisance laws that undermine our liberty, punish everyone equally, and make our world worse. Candy Leitner founded Mothers Against Drunk Driving in 1980 after her daughter was killed by a drunk driver. But she ended up leaving her own organization. Why? Mission creep. Here's what she said. Quote, "Mad has become far more neo-prohibitionist than I had ever wanted or envisioned. I didn't start Mad to deal with alcohol. I started Mad to deal with the issue of drunk driving." She started an organization for a noble purpose, but was incapable of stopping it from expanding its mission far beyond her intentions. As Mad transitioned from fighting drunk driving to more of a zero-tolerance stance on alcohol, she became disenchanted. Mad is now one of the staunchest supporters of Ignition Interlock, a.k.a. prohignition. Yeah, really, that's it. This legislation that is happening all across the country. They've helped pass laws requiring installation of the technology in cars of first-time DUI offenders. But that was just the beginning. An article in USA Today said the group doesn't currently support installing the technology into all cars, not because they don't agree with the concept, but because they don't believe in the technology. Yet. In other words, baby steps. ADD moment. Can you imagine how mandatory breathalyzers would have changed the classic horror movie scene? Blow harder! Quick, blow harder! The monster is coming! Here's something the nanny staters don't like to talk about. The largest percentage of vehicular deaths related to alcohol are from repeat offenders. Therefore, the common sense solution is that you lose your license after a second DUI. Forever. Problem solved. Deter bad behavior by targeting every offender, not every person. But ideas like ignition interlock reverse that. They target everyone with a hope of catching the proverbial drunk needle in the haystack. Drunk drivers? Let's make cars more expensive and force everybody to blow into their dashboard to go to the bank. Millions of law-abiding citizens wind up penalized for the irresponsibility of a relative few. And, of course, the tiny percentage of repeat offenders the technology is actually meant for will find a way to get around it anyway. ADD moment. Never underestimate an alcoholic's resourcefulness. Believe me, I know. One man with an interlock installed on his car simply rented a car that didn't have it. Another repeat offender figured out the best way around it was to use a balloon filled with someone else's alcohol-free breath. Nanny state legislation unrealistically assumes that 100% of human behavior can be corrected. Even in a scary totalitarian state like China. Yes, kids, China's a scary place. This is a place that has over 60 crimes punishable by death. You will still find people there who will break the law. Why is that? If their uncontested, all-powerful government can create any law that would outlaw any behavior they deem undesirable, then why does China have a need for prisons? Or their terrifying mobile execution vans? The answer is simple. No matter what we do, no matter what laws we enact or what creative punishments we invent, there will always be people who will make bad decisions. It's human nature. But more important, it's the price we pay for liberty. What's truly alarming is that those liberties are quietly being chipped away at by federal laws, overzealous city councils, school boards, lobbyists, activist groups, power-hungry politicians. And for a long time, we've sat around and done nothing about it. We shrug our shoulders as officials frighten us with scary, often manipulated statistics. And we applaud draconian legislation because we're told it will save lives, protect the children, keep others from being annoyed, or any of the myriad excuses the nanny staters give. They've learned that it's easier to slowly whittle down your rights rather than seize them en masse, which tends to cause people, you know, to notice. Nannies are truly a bipartisan, eclectic, cross-cultural group. From the pale-faced vegans at PETA working to keep live lobsters out of supermarkets, to the God-fearing folks of Alabama who can't stay out of your bedroom, to the concerned college administrators devising Orwellian speech and conduct codes for students, and bored bureaucrats who simply need to justify their paychecks. It's nearly impossible to pick a nanny stater out of a lineup. Of course, they all do have one thing in common. They're all idiots. Here's what you might face if you ever have the opportunity to argue with one of them. Well, let me tell you this. Lots of people need guidance in their lives, and that's what these laws offer.
So let me get this straight. The government can't efficiently run the post office, the school system, or the DMV. It can't police our borders properly. It failed to prevent the S&L crisis, 9/11, the dot-com bubble, the housing collapse, and the credit crisis. Its IRS created a fully incomprehensible 78,000-page tax code, and its Congress writes bills so long that no one has time to read them. But I should still trust it to make personal decisions for me against my will? I think I'll pass. The fatty fat fatsos of America are a good example of how this works in practice. We can all agree that in most cases, saying it's glandular just doesn't cut it anymore. Obesity is, by and large, caused by someone making bad decisions like eating too many unhealthy foods, sucking down sodas, and using their Nintendo Wii for exercise. But the government ignores those common sense explanations and instead assumes that you're a moron. They believe that you must have no idea that a 64-ounce fountain soda contains an unhealthy amount of sugar.